From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Tis the season of lists of words of the year. Selfie, the Oxford Dictionary people tell us, is the big one of 2013. But there is plenty in motion out there. New words, old words with new meanings, and some striking changes in how we write and speak. My guest today, linguist John McWhorter, has been listening to us all, reading us here and there, watching for the evolution of language this year, thinking about where it takes us. This hour, On Point, from text to tweet to the way we speak, we're looking at language evolution 2013. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your word of the year? Where do you see language going? In our texts, on our tongues? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On his show last month, Conan O'Brien joked about 2013's alleged word of the year.
This is strange. The Oxford Dictionary has named selfie to be the word of the year, narrowly beating out twerk. Yeah. In a related story, the funeral for the English language is this Saturday. Put it in the ground.
Oh, boy. Maybe not. Joining me now from New York is linguist John McWhorter. He teaches English and comparative literature at Columbia University. Is a contributing editor for The New Republic, author of a slew of books on language and more, including What Language Is and Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue. His new book, The Language Hoax, will be out in April. John McWhorter, welcome back to On Point. So wonderful to have you.
Wonderful to be here, Tom.
There's Conan saying, hey, put a fork in it, put our language in the ground. We're down to twerk and selfie. It's all over. Instead, you don't think so, John.
No, I don't. And that's because, to me, language is something to be analyzed and looked at from outside. And so I'm always happy to see as complete a portrait of it as I can get to. And that involves the colloquial parts and the, we might say, pungent parts, as well as the more official high prose parts. And I would say that it's not that the language is dying. But in, for example, words
yes.
like twerk and selfie, I think we do see that if those are the words of the year, if those are the ones that really got around most, we are seeing a hedonistic strand. And it's interesting because I think it seems almost ordinary to most of us in this year that selfie and twerk and things like that would get around. But imagine, I'm not going to say 1890 or 1920.
Yes, yes.
Imagine, say, 1962, you know, the Camelot era, or now we can actually imagine it in color because of Mad Men, now kind of early Mad Men. Can you imagine the words of the year being anything like selfie or twerk, then, these things that are about pleasing ourselves or pleasing other people on a certain level, taking a picture of yourself? It does say something about our society and what gets around. I can't see it as a matter of the language falling apart.
Rump shake and pictures of ourselves. I don't know, in 1862 or 1962, I'm not sure what the equivalent of those might have been. I mean, people call them words of the year, but of course they do that in part exactly because they pick them up because they're a little edgy or out there or even a little debauched in a way that makes it,
exactly.
it makes it tantalizing to call them words of the year.
Definitely. And yet my impression is, you know, it's not that people didn't do things they considered suggestive in 1865. It's not that you couldn't
right.
draw a self-portrait.
Yep.
But notice that drawing a self-portrait wouldn't have become a thing which at the end of that year people would say had become a craze. And as far as whatever the suggestive dance was, like showing your ankle or something like that,
right.
we know it happened. It wasn't the word of the year. And so there's something about us these days. Call us festive, I suppose,
okay.
or in touch with ourselves.
Yep.
That's us, though, rather than what's happening to the English language.
We've got words to look at. We have language dynamics to look at. And a lot of those have grown out of this rich interplay now between texting and speech. Here's a little bit of Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon. This is in September, performing a skit on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, imagining a Twitter conversation in person, including hashtags.
Hey, check it out. I brought you some cookies. Hashtag homemade. Hashtag oatmeal raisin. Hashtag show me the cookie.
Sweet. Hashtag don't mind if I don't. Pretty good. Hashtag getting my cookie on. Hashtag I'm the real cookie monster. Hashtag no, 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 no.
Delicious, right?
Yeah.
Hashtag I did it all for the cookie. Hashtag LOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLO
Twitter, I guess, which is not forever, but which is some years now. But this year, the hashtag, not just the hashtag, but the hashtag sensibility, that kind of semi or fully ironic, commentary attached all over the place, in text and in speech, ubiquitous.
Yeah, and you know, I would disagree with the idea that that kind of irony is new this year or the year before or the year before that. However, labeling it as hashtag and that being another thing of the year, although I think really more accurately hashtag became a thing the year before.
Yeah.
That's still indicative because here's the thing about that clip, which I hadn't heard. Take away the person saying hashtag, and if you think about it, that is the way people talk. Somebody would take a cookie and eat it and say, I'm getting my cookie on, and everybody would giggle in a kind of perfunctory way. That's speech. And texting is really just speech in writing. You do it with your fingers, and it results in letters on a virtual page. But really what you're doing is you're summoning the spontaneous quality of orality, so to speak, in a medium which is mechanically written. And so hashtag is a way of summoning that way that I think we all talk at parties. If you actually did a transcription of the way we have conversations, it's full of that sort of off-to-the-side quotation. Now we have a way of actually writing it.
You put a lot on the table there. I want to unpack that speech into text and text back into speech. But stick with the hashtag for a second because it stands for something a little different when you articulate it. They're not just reading an imaginary tweet there. Isn't there extra quality of remove or framing that's going on with that hashtag?
You know what hashtag is? Hashtag is a way of saying, you know what that's like. There's a whole way of feeling. There's a whole part of being a modern person right now in terms of this cookie eating or this feeling about sex or this feeling about traffic or weather. You know what that's like. I can say it in shorthand by saying something
I know, middle class problems.
Yeah. And the fact that we do that so much indicates that not only are we hedonistic, there's a communal quality to these sorts of things. There's another example of it that is not making the list because it's harder to isolate, but it's what I would call the because fill in the blank construction. And so somebody will say, often nowadays in emails or in tweets, they'll say, I had a hard time getting to work today because rain. And what they mean is kind of like hashtag rain. You know what it's like when it rains and people for some reason drive more slowly, et cetera, et cetera. Or I couldn't manage it today because tired. And it's not just sloppy writing. It's almost kind of like a hashtagless hashtag. Again, it's because you're expected to know what the person means by when you're tired. There are certain things that you can't quite pull off. Communal again. We're all speaking the same language to an extent that we don't even need to use a lot of the words.
You're our linguist. Does it matter if I take out of the because of the rain or because I am tired. Does it matter in terms of the texture or substance of our interaction?
It's so witty. I mean, it's just a matter of, once again, it's putting something that you would let pass easily if you were talking into writing. Imagine some witty person, I imagine it being one of my students at Columbia, who would say something like, and I just couldn't do it because tired, and I'd kind of chuckle to myself. To me, I can't see any reason why that can't be written down, because if that person were writing for the Wall Street Journal, they wouldn't do it. I think we're all bi-dialectal when we write. And so I just think of it as wit written down. How were people witty in 1865? Mm-hmm. We barely know because the fashion meant that you never wrote it down. Mm-hmm. Now we know very well.
Of course, there you point out here directly, there is fashion in language. It has cultural significance. I mean, I hear in that sort of leaving out words, going straight to the whatever it is, rain or tired, there's a kind of intimacy in that, isn't there? We can leave this out. I almost feel like texting, the constant communication now is creating this extra webbing of interaction and connectedness, intimacy.
Exactly. It is that. It's this web. And I'm beginning to sound like a kind of person who I was already tired of 20 years ago with the connectivity and the cyber whatever. But it is this web of connectivity among people. The amount of contact you can maintain with people who you really don't know means that we have returned to what it's like in a village. In a roughly post-Neolithic village where there are 300 people and everybody knows each other more or less. In modern life, we can approximate that. I have 500 Facebook friends. I would say I don't really know about 100 of them. And I would say that about 200 of them are people I would have completely lost contact with just 10 minutes ago in my life. And that's the sort of thing that we have going in this new technological culture. And so some of it can be a little fake, of course. But for the most part, being able to say because tired indicates that more people are understanding each other on a certain level in wider circles than was possible just 10 years ago, even 8. It's a really special time that way.
I mean, connectivity, yeah, it was a concept 20 years ago. Yes, it got boring, but I'm feeling a new body to it now. Not just you can have lists of strangers who are somehow still in your community, but even with those closest to us, the text creates a kind of wink and nod communication that's unending. And you're always in a kind of an intimate relationship wherever you are, even with those you're quite close or can be if you're a texter.
That wink and nod is really key. You can have that wink and nod relationship with a much wider variety of people. And the wink and the nod, I think this is where some people might get a little confused. If you're going to have a wink and nod relationship, the language is going to get creative. And so, of course, you could encode winking and nodding with the kind of prose that a Willa Cather wrote or that an Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote. Or let's get more modern. You could be doing something like Muriel Spark. These are people who can write with a wink and a nod. But you can also write with a wink and a nod in the kind of shorthand that usually we're used to hearing in speech and just letting it go by because we don't think of speech as real language. But really, we can wink and nod in written form. It really does add to the repertoire of the language because the rest of it isn't going away either.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the year in language, 2013, how we write, speak, communicate, and how it is evolving, how it's done so in the last year. The wonderful linguist John McWhorter is with us, author of The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language, coming out in April. Look for it. It's funny. It's like everybody's a linguist these days. Even commercials on television, having fun with the way people, young people in this case, Malcolm McDowell and James Earl Jones, big actors, making fun of how young people, and by their lights, speak and text.
Ryan is a total hottie McHotterson.
Avi, he's amazeballs. He's like the hottest hottie that ever hottied.
He's like a hottie times infinity plus another infinity. And his smile is totes adorbs.
Totes McGoats. It's cray cray adorbs.
Totes McGoats.
And it's all over television. And I have watched young people watch that, listen to that, take that on board. These august voices. I mean, Darth Vader himself speaking there. You write. I mean, there's an inherent or an implicit, more than implicit critique, I guess, there. But a sense of humor at the same time. John McWhorter, you write, the argument that texting is poor writing is analogous then to one that the Rolling Stones is bad music because it doesn't use violas. You say, bring it on.
It's the same thing. Really, if you're reading these texts and thinking that's poor composition, then, well, of course, it is. I mean, if you're going to think about it as some kind of composition, then it completely missed the mark in the same way as if you're listening to Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones and you're wondering where the fugue-like compositional technique is, then, yeah, that song is a really crummy piece of Bach. But the thing is, even though it happens to be written, these texts are talking. You're talking with your fingers. I've called it fingered speech and been told that that's somehow a little gross, so I'll just say that you're talking. Okay. With your fingers. And it does all of the things, these texts, that speech does. Therefore, the punctuation goes out the window because do we punctuate when we talk? No. Of course, it's natural that they don't use the period because do we use periods when we talk? No. Listen to me not using them now. You wouldn't catch me dead saying period or taking a big pause like this to indicate periods. And therefore, you get lots of the slang because slang is common in oral language and not only among young people. Now, there are aspects of tone and register, as linguists call it, such that you wouldn't expect an 80-year-old man who is an august Shakespearean actor or the like to be using these terms in text or in speech. But mark my words, we are at a point where even public speech or even conversations that one has in public are more casual than they used to be. And I will tell you that not too long from now, we are going to see people with gray hair and beginning to have problems with their knees and things like that using like in a way that we now associate with teenagers and 20-somethings.
Why do you think they'll do that? What's the value add in that if they're looking for one? Is it something more emotive or more suggestive rather than precise?
Like in that way is actually, I think. And a study needs to be done. There needs to be somebody who writes at least an article, maybe a book. It's not going to be me. Like has something to do with a hesitation, a certain chariness of expressing a strong viewpoint about something or pushing your viewpoint on someone else.
Yes,
and the extent to which that has become so common in casual American language very well may have something to do with attitudes that even longtime professors see among their students in terms of confidence and expressing strong opinions. But I don't think that's just about being young. That's about being American. And we're going to have people doing it in old age homes when these people get old, because they're not going to stop using like in that way.
There's a hesitation in it. I've also come to begin to see a generosity in it. Here's how I interpret it, but maybe you do it differently. And with that, even a voiced sense of the malleability of reality. Here's what I kind of see, I think see. You may perceive something else, and that's
no,
okay,
Tom,
too.
That was gorgeous. That is exactly it. Yeah. The malleability of reality and an awareness of it. Most definitely, I would say that like, as pasty and uncertain and even unlettered as it can sound, is actually an acknowledgement of the fact that things are not simple, that your view of things might not be the view that other people have. And so it can be seen as something more civilized than just pronouncing. Now, many people would fall all over us for saying that and say that like is just sloppy, et cetera, et cetera.
Can be.
But then again, I don't know if they're aware that there are languages where there's something like that would be called by the linguist a particle, and you might call it something like dubitative or something like that, and it would be considered perfectly ordinary. We have more machinery than we had before like was used so much.
You remind us that writing was only invented 5,000-6,000 years ago, language been around maybe 80,000 years. And so here with this fingered speech or texting as a kind of written speech, it's sort of a comeback of language over writing. Writing, which you also remind us, built its own great complicated castles, maybe overbuilt in some ways.
You know, really, that's true. And I don't remember putting it quite that way, but oddly enough, I was walking down the street thinking of it that way just the other day. Writing allows you to write tapeworm sentences. Writing allows you to put forth an extended argument in a way that
writing,
is hard
not
to
texting.
Do. Traditional writing, yeah. This is quote-unquote real writing. Mm-hmm. It allows you to present an extended argument. It's very easy to miss how crucial extended, layered argument is to actually getting real thinking done, as opposed to the way we talk in bits and pieces. And by we, I mean all people regardless of educational level. But it could be said that the way that, for example, classical texts were written in Latin and Greek, or the way a lot of things are written even today in formal German or Russian, or the kind of writing that we were used to in English 100 years ago, maybe it did overdo it. That was difficult to process. There was a certain kind of elitism. There was a certain kind of recreational complication that often could hide as much as it could reveal. Mm-hmm. Whereas today we're getting down to, well, what language always was until about 10 minutes ago, which is speech, more spontaneous and often just as articulate as the kind of language you see in something like Edward Gibbon's book on the Roman Empire.
I'm curious what some of our great, great speakers in history would do with this turn in evolution. You wrote back in May about saying, yes, you can end a sentence in a preposition. And, of course, Winston Churchill famously demonstrated why when somebody, you know, I was complaining about how that was done, shouldn't be done. And he wrote, this is the kind of nonsense up with which I will not put. drop Winston Churchill down in text speak 2013. Here's a man who was unbelievable with the written, kind of the written language brought to speech, and yet unbelievable speaker who wanted to, above all, communicate and sway. What do you think he would do with our era of text speak, fingered speech?
Oh, he would be disgusted because he was dealing with a different kind of articulateness. And what Churchill did, You know, his writing was what we might call the fusty old-fashioned yes. style. But when he spoke, he was using a kind of poetry, which you could think of as a kind of heightened speech. The sentences were only so long because he was getting himself across to an audience that were listening to him, and often a modestly educated audience. But his idea was that you could use the $10 words that nowadays would be considered much too fussy. And there was nothing wrong with that. And so I wouldn't say that the kind of flinty but high oratory mm-hmm. that he dwelled in was wrong. There was some of that in early Barack Obama. That was part of why he was considered so memorable. But I think part of why he was allowed to speak on that high level was partly because we're used to hearing it from the black preacherly tradition, and that tradition is also a Southern tradition, but I think it's strongly associated in many minds with the black tradition. I don't think, say, a John Edwards could have gotten away with it in an alternate universe as easily as mm-hmm. Barack Obama could. Mm-hmm. But then notice that what Barack Obama really got away with was, yes, we can. And, you know, poignantly I'll say that here all these years later we can see that no, he really couldn't, because nobody really could. He's been an okay president, but I think the lofty idea that we had of him back in 2007 has been shown to have been a kind of flight of fancy. But only somebody with his intonation could have gotten away with saying, yes, we can, in that way. And I think that's partly because of the black tradition. But the fact that anyone could have become so famous with a slogan that spoken is typical of our times. Teddy Roosevelt couldn't have just said, yes, we can. He had to be longer-winded.
Power in language, just three words. Mark in Hingham, Massachusetts is calling. Mark, you're on the air with John McWhorter. Thanks for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I was born to a Beat Generation author who hung out with the likes of Kerouac and Vonnegut, and also a family of academics and so forth. And so I grew up with a very sort of formal teaching of how to use language and how to write and so forth. And I found that the people that I know who are the best at using language formally or informally are really sort of well-educated, smart people. And so I feel like there needs to be a foundation before you can sort of go off the cuff, as it were. And I know I find myself, I think Twitter is actually genius in 140 characters because it forces brevity. So you find yourself having to reword thoughts in a way that, becomes more simple.
But you want us to perfect our Latin or ancient Greek before we start to tweet, Mark?
Well, just to have a good understanding of some of the basic language. For instance, using there versus there the right way. Those types of things.
Let us pick it up with John. Mark, I appreciate your call. What do you think? It all gets blown away in tweets, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, there are two things that he's talking about. Now, if we're talking about your and your and its, the fact is that whether we like it or not, there is a way of looking at those written traditions that involves a certain kind of elitism, a sense of standards. I have those too. So if you're going to write in a certain kind of medium, you need to know when to use its with an apostrophe and when not to, et cetera. That's not going to change any more than it's going to be allowed for people to walk around without clothing, even in hot climates. One simply must deal with those written standards. That is probably a handful of things. But the general idea that before you can mess around with the informal, with tweets, etc., you should have a strong grounding in old Mrs. Grundy's blackboard grammar rules. I understand where that notion comes from, and I think part of it comes from the fact that we highly educated or verbally gifted types had that education, and let's face it, we're a little bit proud of it, and so it's easy to say, well, everybody should have it. But you have to decide, and I don't think that there's any easy answer there, but you have to decide. If you're saying that you can't be an artist with oral language, spontaneous language until you've had a good grounding in the old-fashioned stuff. Unfortunately, you're dismissing the entire body of rap.
And so let's just face it, Jay-Z probably did not have a good grounding in what dangling modifiers are. Mm-hmm. And yet I wouldn't say that that whole book of his rap lyrics could be dismissed as somehow no good. I wouldn't say it. Now, some people would go there, but you have to decide whether you're going to say that. Too many tragically undereducated people today are creating what many people think of as artistic language. So we have to be careful where we go with the prescription that Mark is very understandably making.
Let's hear what others are hearing out there language-wise in 2013. Nashville, Tennessee, Tracy is calling. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First, I wanted to say I really appreciate the points that are being made about Twitter and text and things like that being living speech rather than writing. I have pretty high standards about writing myself, but I really do thoroughly enjoy the witticisms and things like that. And I have a couple of examples. You know, on Twitter, I have intense conversations with people I've never met, part of a kind of a Nashville food community. And we had bad weather a few days ago, tornado warnings and things like that. And people started talking about the Christmas NATO. So
Sharknado, Christmas NATO, Snowmageddon.
Yeah, exactly. Snowmageddon. And we had an argument a while back about mayonnaise brands, which is a very intensely felt topic in the South. And someone coined the term Mayogate. So the Nashville food community was embroiled in Mayogate for quite a while. And the term still pops up on Twitter. So, you know, you see those kinds of things all the time. And I think it's just a hoot.
Yeah, Sharknado, Christmas NATO. I mean, the tornado energy is pumped wherever it can go, John, maybe beyond.
Yep. I mean, it's something that it's hard to see within the span of a lifetime. But words tend to come from things like that. Words often come from jokes, witticisms, things which at the time felt like not real language. So boulderize, gerrymander, those words come from what were proper names. Now, at the time, it would have sounded kind of funny to call something like gerrymandering after Elbridge Gerry a person. But, right. You know, time passes. Who cares who he was? No offense, historians. And so we've got a word. Or I'm going to see if I can get this across in some kind of clear media English. The word arrive does not come from some ordinary Latin verb arrivare or something like that. There was a slang term that was ad ripa, that means to the shore, and then they stuck on a verb ending, ad ripa re. It was a little joke. It was to the shore. Let's to the shore it. It was a slangy little term. Yeah. It became arrivare. Now we say arrive. It came from what would have been a cute little joke among vulgar Latin-speaking teenagers. Words don't just pop up out of nowhere. It's not a matter of somebody saying, I therefore will call this a stapler. It tends to come from some sort of what begins as coinage. So nowadays, we're able to actually write these things down, document them forever, talk about them on NPR. It's really a marvelous thing. And for anybody who sees all of this as, and no offense, Conan O'Brien, anybody who looks at all this and thinks we're just not doing it well is someone who it's like they've never had the opportunity to take a drink. They've never gone out onto the dance floor. Mm. They're missing so much fun.
Do linguists look across large periods of time and denote periods of greater and lesser quality in communication, or do you presume there is some kind of steady state, formal or informal, in human communication quality?
That's a good question, Tom, and I don't think anybody's ever looked at it that way. But I would say that, for example, we're in a time where oral language is being celebrated and documented in a way that I think is quite gorgeous compared to rather recently. We are not in a time when the old-fashioned heightened oratory, such as the Churchillian kind, is as popular as I wish it could be. In an ideal society, we'd have both. So we're not ancient Rome in that way. But then ancient Rome wasn't in a position to celebrate the oral as vibrantly as we do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the year in language, 2013, how we write, speak, communicate, and how it is evolving. Linguist John McWhorter is my guest. He joins us from New York City and Columbia University, author of What Language Is and Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue. Look for his next, The Language Hoax, coming out in April. It's fun online. I mean, everything is mixed, as you say, John. Everything's woven now. It's spoken, it's texted, it's moving all over the place. James says on Facebook, to me, it seems American English is becoming infantilized. Everyone now speaking a more adolescent dialect with selfie and twerk and LOL and emoticons. But Ellen says selfie and twerk are magnificent words, which may be part of why we latch on to them. Kind of visceral poetry there. And Senior says, John McWhorter just compared twerking to showing your ankle back in the day. I'm legit LOLing mass tweet on point, on point radio. So off we go. Emily in Charlottesville, Virginia. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Emily. How are you?
I'm good. I was calling in to say how I'm 15 still, so I'm still a teenager, but the idea that all teenagers, you know, I mean, obviously that's just a mass generalization that all teenagers are speaking, you know, LOL, OMG, LMFAO, you know, all that stuff.
All right, you protest. Right. So what's really going on, Emily?
Yeah, well, me and my friends, we're kind of the nerdy group. I don't know. We have, like, word battles and stuff. I don't know. Our language we use more like, you know, not like selfie and slang and language like in text we do, but I my friends and I, we always punctuate our texts and all that.
Yes.
While it is evolving, not everyone's evolving with it necessarily, or they're keeping to original English, because sometimes it's easier to get a point across that way.
So like, are you making up language as you go? How are you using words then? Do you battle in words?
We're just mostly using like more obfuscated words that you don't really... a lot of times are kind of obscure, and then they have very specific meanings. So it's hard. So like, if you know what the language means, it's easier to use it. But if you don't know what the language means, it's really confusing. You know what I mean?
There's a kind of in-crowd quality to it. Emily, push the limits. You go, girl. I appreciate your calling.
I'm glad Emily called, because she's making a point that I've often noticed, which is that many teenagers and college students have told me, both in person and in other venues, that I don't text like that, or I don't talk like that. And I would venture to say that probably for every teen who does, there's another teen who doesn't. And so, yeah, we don't want to overgeneralize about what it's like to use English when you're 15 or 16 year old. It's 16 years old. In particular, the ones who describe themselves as the nerds or the geeks will mention, often I hear I put periods at the ends of my sentences when I text, etc. But I think that still it stands to reason that the people who do, quote unquote, do that have obtained a purchase in the culture, which is interesting. I used to say, for example, 10 years ago, I used to say that in speech, you'll say something like, the president just didn't show up, but you would never write that. You couldn't imagine a headline saying, the president just doesn't show up, unless it's The Onion. You know, it's gone to the point that I can't say that anymore, because Slate and Salon actually use just and even and sometimes like in their subheads and headlines, because this orality is percolating into what used to be considered the formal realm of language. So no, it's not everybody, but as we all know, it only takes a certain, even vocal minority, to turn the culture upside down. But yes, we don't want to oversimplify. No.
Hashtag culture upside down, or I'm not sure what. Harry in Amherst, New York. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
No, even though you pay obeisance to Winston Churchill, I'm not encouraged by the tone of this conversation, but you can learn something even from bad conversations, and just as the conversation has gone along, I've thought, are all these people who are spending all their time and money with these electronic fads, are they really part of a guerrilla army, excuse me, that's trying to disrupt the National Security Agency's computers and files with all this steady stream of
corrupted language,
a mega tsunami of trivia and twaddle.
Harry, you say bad conversation because you don't like the direction in which what national language use is rolling, Harry?
Well, we've reduced the language to an argot, so nobody understands each other now. We don't have a common language.
I know what you're saying. There's evolution going on, but grab onto a piece of it, Harry, because things are in motion here, and that seems inevitable. John, Harry doesn't like it.
I I can try to put myself into the mind of Harry. And actually, the truth is, I'm not just paying obeisance to Winston Churchill. The truth is that I am inherently a rather starchy person. I do tend to read older things, which is why Muriel Spark was the closest I could come up with earlier in the hour to a modern witty writer. Let me say Gail Collins and Molly Ivins for now to correct myself. Mm-hmm. But I get it. I like old-fashioned prose a lot. I think it's awfully cute. I can honestly say there's no part of me that wishes that that's the way things still were. But God, it was beautiful to read a novel by William Dean Howells, to read even something the New York Times will publish where they'll quote something from an article from 1902. Oh, it's delicious. It's like eating a nice plate of roast lamb. But the fact of the matter is, if you were sitting there in 1902, it's not that there weren't all sorts of other ways of speaking that were going on. It's just that nobody got to have that put into type and put into public papers. And so I think we all have a certain language that we understand now. It's just that we see so much of the rest of it. But very quickly, I think the person is right that there's too much. There are too many sources. Too much is able to be said. I am drowning in all of the verbiage that one has to follow to be a relatively well-informed person. I do wish that we could turn the spigot half off, but I would still hope that what came out of it was a whole lot of talking and writing.
Good luck with that. The technology is democratic, and everybody's got a handle on it. Ulwith in Boston. Ulwith, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I thank you very much because I learn from your show every day, and then I'm still studying English.
Yes.
But my point is, as your guest said, and it's easy when you write, because even me, I still have a problem because I'm studying English as my second language.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes to say something, it, like your guest said before, he said, I usually have a trouble to, like, if I want to say himself, I always have a to say though.
Yes.
And sometimes when I realize I was wrong, and your guess, it's easy for, like, you know, for us to write. And when you write something, and sometimes it make you understand more better, like very good. That's why, you know, I really, you know, I always listen to your show, and I, you know, your show, that very, I'm learning from your program every day. I thank you again for your program.
Oh, with bless you, and I'm so glad you called. This is really interesting, John. I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, all right, hey, let's let some rules down, let the good times roll, you know, with speech and texting and everything going to roll into one. Imagine if you were an English language learner today coming to this gumbo, which has got this broad river of formal language still going on, but then all this creepy crawly stuff all over it as well. What a challenge.
Yeah, because it's harder than it used to be to figure out what is considered to be the right or the proper or the tuxedo form, because you see so much of the rest of it. All in all, I would say that still a person like that is lucky that it means that American English is more forgiving than many linguistic cultures of, for example, accents and different kinds of grammar that are written down. We're more used to that sort of thing than, say, Russians or certainly the French. But yeah, it's harder than it used to be to come here and know exactly what the language is supposed to look like in its Sunday best, because most of the rest of us are beginning to wonder. I can imagine how I would feel if I went to Senegal and had no way of figuring out what the proper Wolof was. Yeah. So, yeah, I hear him.
And no one could tell you exactly whether or not a particular thing was proper. Yeah. It's just the way that Sybil in West Palm Beach, Florida. Sybil, thanks for calling. You're on.
Oh, hello, sir. Understand, English is my second language, and so I had to learn it, paying great attention to grammar and perfecting it all the time. And I believe it's a language that evolves and turns like all other languages with the way people think. And I was taught that you always put I or myself at the end. And you would say Peter, Paul, my brother and myself,
yes,
or my friends and myself.
Yes.
This is no longer the correct way. People say I and then, like the young lady who called previously and said my friend, me and my friend.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and they put themselves to the front of the line.
Right, and I believe it might be associated with the fact that children have been put in front. And you've been raised to be
the first, so you think of yourself first and then the others.
Sybil, you may be right. Your first language must be what? French, I'm hearing.
French, yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, Sybil, that's a great point. Thank you so much. If language evolves with the evolution of the way people think, where are we headed, John?
Oh, no. That's actually what my next book is about. Grammar does not reflect the way its speakers think as a culture in any way that would interest most of us, although it can certainly seem like
how can
it does.
Be? Sybil's, there's a kind of a what feels like a natural logic to what she's saying.
No, like here's how it goes. I'll be doing this interview probably in about 4 months.
Okay.
Chinese is a language that is very telegraphic compared to English.
Yes.
To utter a Chinese sentence, you don't have definite articles. You don't usually have to indicate whether you're in the past or the future.
Yes,
when you're learning Chinese, you have to learn basically not to say a lot of what you're thinking as part of the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go with the idea that grammar is a reflection of culture, then what are we saying about the Chinese mind that the language is so telegraphic? Obviously, something that doesn't correspond. You can't call all of China slightly stupid. And so what it means is that the way that grammar is different from language to language is largely a magnificent kind of accident. Now, with the me and John business with English, the truth is, and this is a book that's been written too many times for me to bother, but the people who decided things like where you're going to put the I or the me in the sentence often were aestheticians. They had a sense that there was a certain way that things were supposed to go. Often they based it on what classical Latin happened to be like. But people in English have been saying me and him for as long as there's been the kind of English that we recognize. And the whole issue as to whether you're supposed to say Billy and me or Billy and I went to the store, that one is one that tends to really irritate the public. But the rule about that, that you're only supposed to say Billy and I rather than Billy and me, that was something somebody just kind of made up. And a French speaker will understand that. Guillaume et moi, right? You would never say Guillaume et je went to the store. And so if it's okay in French, why is it not in English? Because of some men with wigs and breeches about 300 years ago.
Well, we're just
stuck with it. That's a whole different conversation.
We'll have to wait for your book on that. But I have some sympathy with Sybil's point there. There's a kind of good manners in putting yourself last in the sentence, a kind of humility, a kind of modesty, at least to my ear. Susan, in New Haven, Connecticut, you're on the air, Susan.
Hi, Tom. I'm an English teacher for high school students. You can imagine the love-hate relationship I have. I call it textlish. There are certain times when I have to completely embrace how these students communicate and design assessments to really judge what they know and have them communicate it back to me in a language that may not be that grammatically correct. I call it language of success, that someday they may be judged, but at times I have to give in and say, tell me how you understand what I've just told you.
How does that work with their parents or the SATs or even your own sense of good communication, Susan?
Well, it's like I said, it's a love-hate relationship.
Yeah.
I see the children becoming very creative in the way they give the product back to me. However, it does concern me when I have to switch code, so to speak, and say, now write to me what you know in a formal paper with all of the conventions.
What do you say, John?
Susan, I want to ask it. This is a genuine question I want to ask because you're in a position that I'm not. As a linguist, am I idealizing to say that those students can be bidialectal just like people can be bilingual? Do you think that this textless is interfering with their ability?
I don't know if this generation, if it's necessarily interfering, but I think we as educators must understand that this is how they communicate. And if we don't acknowledge that and work with them on that to some level, I think we're going to there's a gap there between our understanding of them and how they communicate. We have to understand it and work with it to a certain degree.
So, but John's question is, can they have both? Can they be awesome communicators in Twitterese and I guess you're saying, John, sort of bring up the formal language and run well with it, Susan?
Yes, I think there can, but I think we as educators have to acknowledge that we can't change this. We're not going to change the way they're speaking. We have to bridge the gap and make them understand by working with them in their language, quote unquote, that they need to bridge the gap. And they have to be able to communicate in that universal language of English, sure, from which they will be judged.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Language of success. And they have to know that. But at the same time, I think these kids are more willing to work with educators if we give them a little room and say, okay, but we understand you're speaking like this, but give us this as educators. You also need to know how to speak like this.
Susan, we've got good luck with that. You've got a tech-powered competitor out there, and it is potent. I'm so glad
and
for your
Tom,
call.
John. I want to quickly add, I want to say that Susan is also right that we do have to train people in that Sunday best language. I'm being very permissive in talking about how glorious all of these more spontaneous forms are. That doesn't mean that people don't have to go with the fashion, which will always be that there's a way to speak in certain public situations and to write. Mm-hmm. I just am hoping that we can embrace bi-dialectalism, just like we don't wonder how anybody could speak both English and Polish, but we'll see.
Patrick on Facebook says, first of all, you are his hero. But he says also, you notice Upspeak and Vocal Fry both got some traction this year. He asks is linguistics becoming mainstream? Are we all thinking and talking about this more? Maybe because of the challenge of styles.
Yeah, I think that the public is becoming much more linguistically conscious in that way, partly because of social media putting it in front of us in such a way. So it's a fun time to be a linguist, just like it's a fun time to be somebody who uses language.
Hang on to your hat. There are winds blowing every which way out there. John McWhorter, you are terrific to be with us late in the year to look back on a year. We thank you so much. Thanks for joining us today.
Always one of my favorite shows. Thanks, Tom.
John McWhorter, he is a professor at Columbia University. His new book, The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language, due out in the spring. Listeners, say that any way you like. We love hearing from you. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.